So let's cultivate our motivation. It's really important in our lives to be congruent, and as much as we possibly can, to act according to our values and to act according to what we espouse publicly. In other words, to not be hypocritical and to not be deceptive. So even when we make mistakes, when we contradict our own values or whatever, to be able to admit that and make amends. So like it says in our posada, that revealing our faults brings peace and happiness, and concealment brings sorrow. And so this is, if we can do this, or to the extent that we can do that, that's the extent to which we live an authentic life. So we're not perfect. We're going to often mess up. But I think that part of being authentic is opening up and revealing that. And so in the same way that we have the value of great compassion towards all living beings, but it's very difficult to actually hold that in mind during the day and to act according to that, to admit that and then make amends and keep trying. So in the same way that when we don't like something, we ruminate about it and go over and over and over it again, each time increasing our jealousy or anger, whatever it is, the negative emotion we're having. In the same way, you know, we should familiarize ourselves with virtuous states of mind, bringing them to mind again and again and again, and familiarizing ourselves. And so owning when we mess up, and then again, going back to the process of familiarization. And in that way, to progress along the path to full awakening and to be able to cultivate the qualities and the wisdoms that constitute the causes for Buddhahood. So with that kind of motivation, then let's listen this evening. So a few things have happened in the last few days that led me to make this motivation. Situations I've heard of where people are acting deceptively or not acting according to what they espouse or the face that they show publicly. And I was thinking in particular, you know, of some discussions that we sometimes have at the Abbey with people who come here whose family members think in a very, very different way in terms of politics and policies and things like that, and how people have to juggle relating to family members who have quite strong views that don't agree with theirs, and how important it is to remain authentic but to not be confrontational and combative with these people. Yeah. And then also the topic has come up in some discussions about, you know, when people do express racist or, you know, other kinds of bigoted opinions, you know, what to say or what to do. Do you just keep quiet, you know, and pretend you didn't hear it? Do you say something and risk the other person getting angry? If you say something, how do you say it? And one of the people at the lunch yesterday, one of our friends who is here, you know, who comes here a lot, she and her husband live in a quite nice part of town, and one of the neighbors' houses were for sale, and they saw somebody that they knew who was driving around in the neighborhood, and they said hello. They didn't know this family very well, but they had lived a few blocks away from where they used to live, and it was a gypsy family, and they said that they were going to make a bid on this house. And so our friend was very excited, you know, and she said, oh good, I can't wait to have you for neighbors, and you know, when you move in, we'll make a nice party and introduce all the other neighbors to you, because they have like a little community there. And so that was that. So she was quite excited and pleased by that. And then a week or two later, you know, she saw the neighbors whose house was for sale, and their for sale sign had been taken down. And she said, oh, did you sell the house, you know, to this family? I'm so pleased, you know, that they're going to be our neighbors. And the people who own the house said, oh, we wouldn't do that to you. And our friend was just like stunned, totally stunned. And it wound up that a few of the other neighbors thought like this particular person too. And, you know, I don't know what she said. I need to ask her, actually. Because she was so stunned. And when she told the story, I was too. It's like, you know, because it's hard to believe sometimes that people that you know, especially, you know, in your own community, would think and act like that. Yeah. So to me, that, you know, it's, how do we deal with those kinds of situations and remain true to our own values and speak up and yet remain as a friendly neighbor and not create a lot of conflict? Yeah. So that's a real challenge, but I think it's something very important, because if we ignore that, then that it's, you know, in a way, it's kind of like subtly condoning that way of thinking. Yeah. There was an interesting article by James Comey in the New York Times, and he talked about how Trump wears on people like Barr and, you know, Cohen and all these different people. And it was a very, very interesting article. And I'm talking about this, you know, because it has to do with the mind and the way human beings think and about ethical conduct. I really recommend the article if you can read it. It's still there. But he was saying that, you know, you're in meetings and the president would just speak. And here I'm just using the example of Trump. It happens all the time in our own families, in our own workplaces and so on, you know. But the president would just speak kind of nonstop and lay out his ideas. And then when there was time for discussion, his position was so strong and clear that nobody dared say anything. Yeah. And how this, even though Comey was saying, you know, even though you feel uncomfortable inside about what was said, nobody else is saying anything. So then you start to doubt yourself, or you think, you know, oh, if I say something, I'm just creating conflict. These people are going to disagree. And after all, he is the president. And, you know, and so he was explaining how you just subtly get sucked in to thinking that way and behaving that way, even though deep down you don't agree with it. Yeah. And so it was making me think, you know, how many situations in our life do we encounter like that, where we know what somebody's saying or doing isn't right, and but we just keep quiet. I'm not talking about saying something in this situation. He's not doing anything to you, Maitri. If he was doing something bad, then you could say that's not a good thing to do. But he's not doing anything. Kitty politics. Yeah, but how easy it is, you know, that there's a kind of group think sometimes, and you don't really feel comfortable with it, but you can't say anything. And then how slowly your own mind changes, you know. And so Comey was saying this is what happens, what he's seen happen to people who start out as very reputable, competent people in the administration, and then slowly, you know, start sliding down the slippery slope. Yeah, so it was making me think, you know, I mean, all these kinds of things that I hear and see. It's like, okay, well, what about me? Do I do that? And what kind of situation am I afraid to speak up in? And do I just acquiesce to things that I don't think are good because I don't want to stick out, you know, and make a fuss? Yeah, and how that leads to, you know, not being quite authentic. Not that I'm saying we need to, you know, go to the other extreme and just blurt out whatever we think without any thought to how to explain something so the other person can understand it, you know. Because if we want to communicate, it's not just about, I feel this, blah. It's about, okay, this is troubling. How can I explain it to the other person in a way that they can hear it and understand it? Okay. And, you know, so there's so many areas in our life, I think, where we need to think about that. Yeah, and be truthful. Okay, so we're back to categories. So I have a question for you. Last time we were talking about different kinds of ways, different divisions. Yeah? Do you remember what they are? Yeah? Hmm?
There's four of them.
Yeah.
One is like where the category is split completely and cover everything.
Yeah.
And one is in, like, an illustration, or what's the word for it? Two of them aren't like that at all. One is where things split and not everything is encompassed by it. That's the second one. And one is, the third one I didn't really understand. It's like a making illustrations, if I remember right. And the fourth one was more like nominal.
Yeah. Okay, so there's the first one where it's all things and they're divided and they fit into one of the categories that you're talking about. And then the second one was it fits into the categories, but there's some little thing that is part of that whole but doesn't fit into either of the categories. And then the third one was where you might have a few categories, but one of the categories encompasses the other one. Yeah. So the illustration was explicit phenomena and hidden phenomena, you know, because phenomena are divided into those two. But actually, all the explicit phenomena are actually hidden phenomena too, according to the definitions of both of those. And then the fourth one was a terminological division, where not everything that was called that was actually a division of that. Okay? So, I want to ask you a question. What about beans? Okay? beans. Yeah. B-E-A-N-S, as in kidney beans, garbanzo beans, lima beans. Okay? Okay. Because this is very practical. You'll see. I'm getting to a point. Okay. So when you divide beans, what do you come up with? Yeah, what kind of division is that one?
It depends on what divisions you use.
Yeah, but give some divisions, make something up, yeah.
An example of a true partition with nothing left over would be those who eat beans at the Abbey and those who don't eat beans at the Abbey.
Okay, yeah, that's one way to divide it. Right? And that would be a partition with nothing left over. Except what about people who eat beans sometimes? Or eat some beans. So maybe you have to divide it into three categories. Those that don't eat any beans, those that mean all beans, and those that eat some beans. Okay. Yeah?
Green beans. They're a vegetable.
Oh, now green beans, where do they fit in? Are they a division of beans, or are they a terminological thing?
Are there beans inside?
Yes.
They're just not a mature bean.
Yeah.
They're
the pods. So are they beans, or are they a terminological thing, something that's called beans, but they're not real beans?
They are beans. A different kind of division would be fresh beans or dried beans.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. So kind of fresh beans or dry. But okay, so you will include green beans as one type of bean.
Fresh beans.
Okay. But if you divide them into fresh beans and dried beans, but if you can divide them into like kidney beans and lima beans, then can green beans be one of them?
Sure.
Okay. What about garbanzo beans?
Yes.
Are they beans?
Yes.
Okay. Now,
soybeans?
Mung beans? Black beans?
White beans? And brown beans? But how about lentils?
Yeah. What about lentils? Are they a kind of bean? I don't know. Are they beans or are they? No, they're not beans. Legumes. Sure.
So beans are legumes too.
Yeah. No, beans are the fruit of the plant, you know, biologically. Okay, so when somebody writes down about foods they eat and they don't eat, and they put beans, okay, when you're the cook, then what does that mean to you?
It means they eat lentils and green beans, but none of the others.
Okay, it means they eat lentils and green beans. Yeah, but none of the others.
In the kitchen, sometimes the word bean is crossed off, and then it just says like dark beans or like only light beans, that kind of thing. And then you have to decide what's a light bean and what's a dark bean.
That's true. Okay, but if somebody just says they don't eat beans, then do you cook, make a lot of dishes with, let's say, garbanzo beans, thinking that they don't count as beans, or lots of dishes with yes, I'm making a point.
Then you serve,
I'm being truceful here.
Then you serve tofu in addition to beans if you're the cook, or you find out what that person can eat.
Yeah.
Other than beans.
Yeah. But sometimes... Yeah, there's many kinds of beans as dishes. Yeah.
Musical fruit.
Yes, it's very musical. So I'm just trying to just see. You know, kind of when we write things about what we eat and what we don't eat, what does that mean to the people who cook?
It means you need a computer to figure out how to
teach people. Yeah, we have a computer in the kitchen. Yeah, but it's just interesting. What? No what?
There's no computer.
I see one sometimes in the desk.
That's individual. People bring their computers in.
Well, it's still a computer. What, you think under the category of computers, there's no division of my computer and your computer? Yeah. Come on. Okay, so it's just an interesting thing, you know, when people say they eat this or that, kind of what gets communicated, yeah, and is it necessary to spell out all the different kinds of beans, or is just saying beans sufficient, or, you know, like, do all people consider, like you were saying, for you, they would eat green beans, and they would eat
lentils.
Okay.
They might eat green beans, but not lentils.
Too many times. Yeah, they would eat green beans and not lentils. Yeah, you know me.
Well, what about
edamame? What's edamame? You ate a mommy? Did you eat a daddy too?
The snow beans.
Soybeans in the pot.
Oh, yeah, fresh. They're beans, aren't they? Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly.
So you still make them? Yeah. You don't make them because I what? Huh?
Soybeans are legumes.
Oh. They're all legumes. Beans, peas, cowpeas. They're all legumes.
Lentils.
Peanuts.
How about you care? Beans and legumes.
Okay, so...
There's a definition here in the dictionary.
Okay, beans. Of what?
Bean.
Okay.
An edible seed, typically kidney-shaped, growing in long pods on certain leguminous plants, or a leguminous plant that bears beans in pods.
There's a three possibilities. Legumes is the bigger category, and beans is a subset.
Lentils is a subset.
Okay, we need a biologist here. But do you see what I'm getting at here? Like when we say different words, what does it really encompass to different people? And what is it that we think that people eat or don't eat? And do people need to list out everything, every kind of bean they eat or every kind of bean they don't eat? Yeah.
It's obviously what's needed.
Okay. Yeah. But quite interesting, you know, when we think of categories. And here's something that Christina wrote. Yeah. This will probably be the last class where we call her Christina.
Aww.
Yeah. Okay, so she said, I just wanted to share some insights again by watching the divisions of my mind, the divisions my mind makes in daily life this past week. I've noticed how the labels I put on objects or categories, I put them into usually have a layer of moral judgment associated with them. Okay, for example, things I like are good, right, and attractive, while things I don't like are bad, wrong, and ugly. And inherently so, because at the time it doesn't seem possible for them to be any other way. Okay, the goodness and badness appears to adhere in the object. It's clear how such a narrow division of good versus bad locks us into a narrow view of things without any recognition of context, our current mood, or how other people might view the object or how the object changes over time. Yeah? Which is why it's totally consistent that I eat the steamed soybeans and I don't eat garbanzo beans or kidney beans. Or black beans, or lentils. I'll eat the white beans once in a while, the big lima beans, once in a while. Okay, but it depends on context. Like that's what she's pointing out. So you see, I'm totally consistent. Right? Yeah. What do you say? No. Thinking about this further, I realize that although dichotomies like good and bad seem to be a true partition with nothing left over, boy, that's some way to see life. You know, what's the cup? Is it good or bad? They could also be seen as non-comprehensive division with some leftover because it leaves out the category of neutral, okay, kind of good and kind of bad, good or bad right at this moment, but not later on, and so on.
Yeah.
It's true, isn't it? Yeah. I also thought about the friend, enemy, stranger division, how this could be seen as a non-comprehensive division with some leftover because it leaves out categories like frenemy. Could you look that one up? F-R-E-N-E-M-Y. I've never heard it. Is it a word?
Yeah, it's a word.
Frenemy. She said, a kind of friend in name only. Oh, so a terminological friend. Yeah. You see frenemy?
A person with whom one is friendly despite a fundamental dislike or rivalry.
Okay, because, thinking of it as a non-comprehensive division with some leftover, because it leaves out categories like frenemy and acquaintances, strangers I feel an affinity with versus strangers I feel averse to due to some characteristics like their politics or religions, a friend I am currently mad at, an enemy who is currently being nice to me, and Yeah. But it's true, isn't it? You know, we usually think friend, enemy, and strangers, but if we think more deeply, there's really a lot of other categories, what we might call gray areas. These are basic observations, but on the meditation cushion, they actually seem quite profound to me, because I saw how my mind creates the world I inhabit by labeling objects or situations as inherently desirable or undesirable when there are actually many, many ways to view them. Yeah? So that's a good observation. And, you know, really thinking, you know, applying all of this to our life, you know, really thinking about how the kinds of categories that we have in our mind that we may not even be aware of, but that we are the lens through which we see things. Yeah, like good, bad. Yeah, I like, I don't like. Yeah, it helps me, it harms me. And, you know, those are categories that we divide things into, but often without even realizing we have those categories. Yeah. And then we put somebody in that category and or something in that category, and it remains that way. And in that way, we often can really trap ourselves. Yeah, especially if we say to ourselves, I never like people who fill in the blank, you know? And then, of course, you meet somebody who does that, who's a very nice person, and then you get very conflicted. Yeah, because you already kind of made a determination to yourself that you never are going to like people like that. But then here's somebody you met who is like that you like. So I think we were at exercise 20.1, right? Did you play with the exercise? Okay, so let's have some people who played with the exercise, who did it. Venerable Tarpa and... Okay, let's have Venerable Lamsa. Okay, so you do the first one. Okay, don't look at the book.
What's the definition of a form source?
The subject, an object apprehended by a visual consciousness.
Form source, there's...
also called visual form.
Yeah, you have to be more specific, because form source can also include the eye organ.
I don't know, I just used the definition given in this book.
Okay.
The definition of this book is an object. Well, you can use visual form.
But yeah.
They had it for us both.
Yeah.
So visual form was the definition of a visual form.
Object apprehended by the eye consciousness.
Yes. Yes, that's right. No, that's what you say. It follows that the subject, an object apprehended by the visual consciousness, is a visual form.
I accept.
Why do you say the subject, an object apprehended by the visual consciousness, is a visual form?
My memory. Okay. Because I have to look at the book. Because it and visual form share the eight doors of pervasion that are shared by a definition and a definiendum, and they are established as having the relationship of definition and definiendum.
Yeah.
Okay. It follows that an object apprehended by a visual consciousness is a visual form because it shares the eight doors of pervasion of a definition and definiendum.
I accept.
And they share the relationship of a definition and the definiendum.
I accept.
Really? What are those eight?
The subject whatever is a visual form is necessarily an object apprehended by a visual consciousness. Whatever is an object apprehended by a visual consciousness is necessarily a visual form. Whatever is not a visual form is necessarily not an object apprehended by a visual consciousness. Whatever is not an object apprehended by a visual consciousness is necessarily not a visual form. If a visual form exists, an object apprehended by a visual consciousness exists. If an object apprehended by a visual consciousness exists, a visual form exists. If a visual form does not exist, an object apprehended by a visual consciousness does not exist. If an object apprehended by a visual consciousness does not exist, a visual form does not exist.
It follows that these eight pervasions exist between an object apprehended by a visual consciousness and a visual form. And then because of that, the object apprehended by a visual consciousness and a visual form are ascertained as having the eight approaches of pervasion that exist between a definition and a definiendum.
Except.
Now it follows that an object apprehended by a visual consciousness and form source are established in the relationship of definition and definiendum.
I accept.
Why?
It is so because in order to apprehend a visual form, one must first ascertain. To apprehend visual form with a valid cognizer or a reliable cognizer, one must first ascertain that which is, must first ascertain an object apprehended by a visual consciousness with a reliable cognizer.
And they are...
And they are mutually different. And they are mutually exclusive phenomena.
No.
Mutually different.
Mutually different phenomena.
They're different.
Yeah. That's what he says.
Okay. It follows that they are mutually different phenomena and that in order to ascertain with valid cognition a visual form, one must first ascertain with valid cognition an object that is... ascertainable by visual consciousness.
I accept.
That's the end.
Wait a minute, I'm going to go back. You're saying what was saying before. You're saying that
so they are established in a relationship of a definition and a definiendum because one, they are mutually different phenomena, and two,
okay.
in order to ascertain visual form with a reliable cognizer, a person must first ascertain an object realized by a visual consciousness with a reliable cognizer.
Okay. So it says, now abiding in bliss, dissolve into rainbow light. Oh, you can still dissolve. Yeah?
Why do they say you have to apprehend one first and then the other? Why is there that order?
Because if I say to you, just like the example before, you know, frenemy. Yeah. If you say to me, frenemy, I go, what in the world is a frenemy? I have no way of knowing what a frenemy is. You know, if you say, oh, it's like how I relate to Joe Schmo. I kind of get along with him, but we have really big differences. Yeah. And I know Joe Schmo and how you relate to him. Then that's something that illustrates the definition of frenemy. And then I go, oh, okay. Now I'm a little bit closer to understanding what a frenemy is. Okay. So I have to understand something that fits the definition and understand the definition before I really understand what the definiendum is. Okay? Okay. Who wants to do another one?
What's the definition of definition? Does definition have a definition?
The subject, that which is a triply qualified substantial existent.
And follows the subject, that which is a triply qualified substantial existence is the definition of definition.
Except.
why do you say that the subject, that which is a triply qualified substantial existence is the definition of a definition?
Because it and definition are established as having the eight doors of privation, and they are established within the relationship of a definition and its definiendum.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so it follows that that which is that which exists as, or that which is a triply qualified substantial existence and definition are ascertained as having the eight approaches of privation that exists between definition and
Don't look at your book. You can't look at the book.
I accept.
Really? What are those eight?
Yes, there are. They are all eight, and they are whatever is a definition is a triply qualified substantial existent. Whatever is a triply qualified substantial existent is a definition. Whatever is not a definition is not a triply qualified substantial existent. Whatever is not a triply qualified substantial existent is not a definition. If a definition does not exist, or if a definition does exist, then a triply qualified substantial existent does exist. If a triply qualified substantial existent does not exist, then a definition does exist. Then a triply qualified substantial does exist. If a definition does not exist, then a triply qualified substantial existent does not exist. And if a triply qualified substantial existent does not exist, then a definition does not exist.
So it follows that the eight doors of privation, you don't have to include the word necessarily.
You probably do.
Just checking. Okay. It follows that if those eight pervasions exist between that which is triply qualified, substantial, existent, and definition, then that which is a triply qualified, substantial, existent, and definition are ascertained as having the eight approaches of pervasion that exist between a definition and a definitionum.
I accept.
Okay. It follows that that which is a triply qualified substantial existent and definition are established in the relationships of definition and definiendum.
I accept.
Why do you say that's the case?
Because it and definition are mutually different phenomena, and in order to realize definition, you first must realize with valid cognition that a triply qualified substantial existent.
Mm-hmm. With reliable cognition. Okay. Mm-hmm. So it follows that if they are mutually different phenomena, and in order to ascertain a definition with valid cognition, a person must first ascertain a triply qualified substantial existent with a valid cognition.
Except.
Okay, good.
Okay. So clear?
I can mud.
Clear as mud. Okay. So practice this next week. Yeah, you have to practice, you know, with somebody and go back and forth and say this again and again and again. And then it becomes clear. And then you begin to see, you know, when you're setting up the syllogism, even of giving a definition, that first you have to check if the reason applies to the subject, and then you have to check if there's pervasion between the reason and the thesis or the predicate. Okay, so you have to use those things in this case, just even to define something. Yeah? Okay, so, there's a lot of things here. Okay, let's do 20.4. Okay, so here he's saying, that, you can, he's saying, identify what would be the problem with defining the definiendum in the way that it is in these following numbers. You will find that the problem is that the proposed definition does not include all that it should. That's one alternative. or the proposed definition includes more than it should, or three, there are faults of non-occurrences where you can't find anything that fits the definition. Okay, so what would be the problem with defining color as that which is suitable as a red hue? It's what?
It doesn't include everything.
Yeah, it doesn't include everything. Yeah, so it's too narrow of a definition. What would be the problem with defining color as that which is visible?
It's too broad.
Yeah, it's too broad. It includes more than it should. What would be the problem with defining a permanent phenomena as the non-momentary?
Yeah.
What's the problem with defining a permanent phenomena as the non-momentary?
It's too broad. It would include non-existence.
Yeah, it's that's the non-momentary. It's too narrow because it doesn't include non-existence.
No, it's too broad because it does include.
It includes more than it should
because it would include.
Oh, okay. Okay, yeah, it's too broad. Okay, so what would be the problem with defining a sound as that arisen from the element? It's a fault of non-occurrence?
I think so.
There's no sounds arisen from the elements?
Earth, water, fire, and air, I thought were separate from sound.
Yeah, but here when it's talking about elements, I don't think it means just those four things. It means those things, you know, combinations of those things that form, like this is something that is, what do they call it? Arisen from the elements. It's not just talking about those elements. It's talking about things arisen from the elements. Which would be, you know, the gong and our body and the table and everything like that. Okay, so what's the problem with defining sound as that arisen from the elements?
It doesn't bother me.
It includes more than it should.
Well, aren't there sounds that are arisen from the element?
Yeah. Things that are risen from the elements.
No, remember when we studied sound? There was one division of sound as, you know, a sound arisen from the element. And things were like the ringing of the gong.
So there are two. There's the sounds caused by elements conjoined with consciousness.
Yeah.
And sounds not conjoined with consciousness.
Right.
So this one doesn't include all that it should.
No, it includes more than it should because lots of other things are arisen from...
Oh, okay. Looking at... Okay.
Well, wait a minute. Maybe it's a little bit of both. Are you sure? Why can't it be? Okay. So what is there something that... is a sound that is not arisen from the elements?
No, not according to this system. So sound is a form, and all form is arisen from
the elements. But wasn't there sound? There was sound arisen from... elements conjoined with consciousness.
Elements conjoined or non-conjoined.
Yeah, conjoined or non-conjoined. Okay, so there's nothing that's a sound that is not arisen from the elements. Is that what you're saying?
I see it as a situation of non-occurrence because tangible objects are divided into... objects that are elements and tangible objects that are arisen from the elements. So I think sound is a separate category, and that arisen from elements would be a tangible object, not a sound. not a sound object. Hmm.
Look at the divisions of sound and see what he has.
Yep.
Doesn't articulate sound caused by elements?
Yeah. There's some similarities there, but I think it's really...
But isn't caused by the elements, arisen by the elements?
If you look at tangible objects, they're divided into tangible objects that are elements and tangible objects that are arisen from the elements, whereas sound is different.
So sound is a ninth potency.
But tangible objects that are arisen from the elements are different than that arisen from the elements, isn't it?
It says, thus, like the other, sound too is materially established, but not in the same sense that other forms are. Also, sound has an extremely short duration. Thus, in their way of thinking, the four elements provide the bases for all material phenomena. All the rest of matter, visible forms, sounds, odors, tastes, and the other tangible objects, such as smoothness, are arisen from the elements. So all visible forms, sounds, odors, tastes, and so on, are arisen from elements.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So what's the problem of defining a sound as that arisen from the elements? It's too broad.
Includes all form.
Yeah. That arisen from the elements would include all form. And sound doesn't. Okay. Let's right. Could you read that sentence again? Venerable Sangha Gaudro. Let me see if I where's my note?
182.
Uh-huh.
Right down at the bottom before the note. All the rest of matter, visible forms, sounds, odors, tastes, and other tangible objects such as smoothness are arisen from the elements. Although I have never seen it done this way, it seems that it would be suitable to divide all matter into the same two groups as the tangible objects are divided into the elements and what is arisen from the elements. Top of page 183. So even though only tangible objects are divided in that way, he's saying it seems like all matter could be divided in that way too.
But he was saying all matter could be divided into either the elements or that arisen from the elements.
The tangible objects are divided into those that are the elements and those that are arisen from the elements.
Yeah, but that's a division of tangible.
Right, right.
But into tangible objects.
Yes, I realize that. But what I'm saying is, he's saying it would be suitable to do that with all groups. I don't think so. I think only the tangible objects could be the elements. The others are all arisen from.
Oh, okay.
So I don't, that's why he probably has never seen that. Because all sounds are listed as having been arisen from. Uh-huh. None of them are listed as being the elements.
Mm-hmm.
It would be the same with odors, tastes.
Yeah. Right. But what she said is it seems all matter could be divided into the elements or that arisen from the elements.
Yeah, he says, although I have never seen it done this way, it seems that it would be suitable to divide all.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem to me like it would be because all the others are arisen. They're not the elements and arisen.
They all contain the elements.
Yeah.
They all contain the elements.
Yeah, that's why they're arisen from it. But they include, as tangible objects, they include the four elements as the tangible objects.
Yeah, but here he's just saying all matter, which includes form and everything, you know, you have this whole thing of all matter, could be either the elements or that arisen from the elements.
I see that. Well, I'm saying that there's a problem with that, that you couldn't say that a sound is an element. It's arisen from the element.
Yeah, but that's why he's not saying and, it's or. It's either an element or arisen from an element. So a sound is arisen from an element, but it's not an element.
So part of that division has four things and part of that division has
four
things.
So he wouldn't divide each group into that. He would divide
no,
all.
No, that's yes. what he said, all.
Right, yeah.
You okay. know, all matter.
Yeah.
Okay. So five, what would be the problem with defining a consciousness as a non-mistaken knower? Too narrow? What's an example of something that's a consciousness but not a non-mistaken knower?
Wrong consciousness.
What are those? Your mind has only wrong consciousnesses?
No, that's an exaggeration.
Okay.
Conceptual.
Yeah. Okay. So what would be the problem with defining an uncertain consciousness, that is a doubting consciousness, or a consciousness of suspicion, as a knower that thoroughly engages its objects? Its object. There's non-occurrence, yeah. Why? Yeah.
Something else, but if you had a doubt that was tending towards the fact,
mm-hmm.
Would that be a non-occurrence, or is it just that the definition is too broad?
Here,
it really can't be thoroughly engages. You know, thoroughly engages in the book said it meant that it knows the object exactly as it is.
Right. So does a doubt consciousness, even one inclined towards the correct conclusion, does that know the object as it is? Does it know the object correctly?
It doesn't seem so to me, but I wasn't so sure when you say tending toward the fact.
Yeah. Tending, it's still a doubt.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's still a doubt. And doubt doesn't know the object.
So then it is a non-occurrence.
Yeah.
So there's no examples that would go in there.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
Okay. Because even a correct assumption doesn't thoroughly engage the object, and it's one step up from doubt. Yeah?
Okay.
What exactly is thoroughly engaging with mean?
That's what I looked up in the book.
Yeah.
Basically, realization.
Yeah. It realizes the object. Okay. Okay. What would be the problem with defining a correctly assuming consciousness as a knower without a reason that does not get at an object with respect to which superimposition has been eliminated, although it adheres one-pointedly to the phenomena that is its principal object of engagement?
There is no problem.
It's too narrow. It doesn't include the other two.
If you look it up, it includes all of that.
This is without a reason. So there's the three types of correct assumption. This is only one of them.
Mm-hmm.
It's correct assumption without a reason, whereas there are two other types of correct assumption.
You have one with
a
wrong
reason. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. Okay. Okay. So it's too narrow. What would be the problem with defining a reliable cognizer as a non-mistaken knower free from conceptuality?
I was going to say too narrow because not all reliable cognizers are non-conceptual.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's too narrow. Okay? So this is good. So we should, you know, be aware in our lives as we go through things, how we define certain objects and check with other people if they define them in the same way. Because we may have an idea of something that's too narrow or too broad, like our discussion with beans showed. you know, what people considered beans. Yeah, some people's definition was too narrow, some too broad. Actually, we never know. We never figured out what exactly is a bean. Yeah. But we know that it's not a thing of non-occurrence because there are beans. Okay. So then, okay, then he gave you an exercise, you know, take something that you are familiar with and try to list all the divisions of that type of thing. And as we started out with the beans, we came out with many ways, you know, what is eaten at the Yavi, what is not eaten, you know. So many ways to categorize one major thing, many ways to divide it. Okay, should we go on to one indifferent? Okay, so there is an important division of established spaces into the two, phenomena that are one and phenomena that are different. This division is a true partition with nothing left over. Every existent and every group of existents we may speak of are included in one or the other, but not both, depending on what we refer to. This also includes established base itself. So one may also be described as one, meaning, yeah, can also be described as a singular phenomena. The one or the singular phenomena is defined as a phenomena that is not diverse. Okay, so here diverse means it can mean many, you know. Yeah. If a phenomena is not diverse, it must be singular. Diversity requires duality or multiplicity. An example of one or a singular phenomena is a pot. Different or different phenomena are defined as phenomena that are diverse. Now here, you know, they divide it into one and different. Sometimes they divide it into one and many. And the way it's explained can be different, especially when you, because this comes up a lot when you're investigating, you know, analyzing to realize emptiness. For example, to see whether the person is one or different from the aggregates. Yeah. And so there, one or different is meaning, you know, is it the same? Is it the same? Yeah, or are they diverse phenomena? But another way, which Jeffrey accentuates a lot, is making it one or many, where one just means the number one, singular, and many means it's more than one, you know, so kind of like a number-wise. So just so that you're aware that sometimes when you find this vocabulary of one and different, it can also be translated as one and many, and it can be considered differently. Yeah. You might remember one time when Jeffrey was here and he was going through. Do you remember that? And he, you know, is this one or many, you know, and is this one or many? And he was going through a lot of things. And it's quite interesting, you know, because you say, is this one or many? And our instant reaction is one, but, you know, the parts are many. So is it really one or is it really many? But that's another topic. Okay. If phenomena are diverse, there must be at least two of them. Thus, the definition specifies the plural phenomena. An example is the two, a gold pot and a copper pot, back to gold pots already, which are separate and distinct phenomena. Okay? When you have, we don't have right here, but if we had two white cups, are they one or are they different?
Different.
Why are they different?
Diverse.
But they look exactly the same.
If you broke one, the other is unaffected. He mentions that in here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. But in normal English, you would say you know, they're identical, wouldn't you? You'd say they're the same.
Same is the same as one in this system.
Yeah. Same means one, but in regular English, same doesn't mean one. Yeah. Same just means they look alike. Doesn't mean they are the same thing. Yeah. So these kinds of things where the usual meaning of the English word and the technical meaning in debate are different, you know, so we have to be aware of that. Okay, both of these definitions limit one and different to phenomena. This is a division of established bases, and in this tradition of thought, they are saying that a non-existent is neither one nor different. But isn't a non-existent different than an existent?
Non-existent doesn't have any qualities, so you can't say that it has the quality of being different from an existent.
Well, yes, it does, because an existent has qualities and a non-existent doesn't, so they're different.
The definition is phenomena that are diverse.
Yeah, so why isn't non-existent a phenomena? There are many things that are non-existent. We talk about them all the time.
It cannot be.
Phenomena is something that holds its own entity.
What does that mean? Hold its own entity.
Hold it.
It holds an entity? What do you mean? What does hold an entity mean?
Phenomena is mutually inclusive with existence, according to the definition.
Yeah. So? It's wrong.
You can't observe a non-existent with a reliable cognizer.
What?
You can't observe a non-existent with a reliable cognizer.
But you can sure talk about them.
And?
And you can vote for them. And you can devote your whole life to them. I think non-existents are very powerful. Yeah? I mean, look at inherent existence is non-existent. But we devote our whole life to it, to thinking, you know, that way. Yeah. And when you fall in love, that person is perfect. Yeah, no faults. Yeah. Then that's a right cognizer, isn't it?
For a while.
For a while.
What do you mean for a while? It either is or isn't. That's not a good answer.
You realize it's not.
Oh, Anna, we're shocking you. I'm sorry. Yeah. Okay. What does it mean to hold its own entity? A phenomena holds its own entity. What does that mean?
Well, in this system, isn't it that they believe that objects actually have an inherently existent quality that makes it? So,
no, but even Prasangika say phenomena hold their own entity.
So conventionally they have specific qualities that we label onto the mm-hmm. definition.
But it says they have specific qualities, but they hold their own entity, and entity is one thing, and qualities or characteristics are many things. What does it mean? It holds its own entity.
It is itself.
We should ask our teacher.
Now, this is something I've wondered for a long time. You see it in every debate book, in every definition. A phenomena holds its own entity. What does that mean? Yeah. Probably. I think it means like it has its own conventional nature. That's what I've been able to come to. But if you look for, you know, as specific as they are for definitions, there's no definition for nature or for entity. Yeah, there's a few of these very key terms that are not defined. At least I haven't been able to find any definition. Okay, so I don't know, think about it. What does it mean? Okay.
That thing is identical with itself.
Yeah, but that's something else. That's what we're getting into. Okay. Okay. Okay, this is a division of established basis, and in this tradition of thought, they are saying that a non-existent is neither one nor different. You know, but if a non-existent doesn't exist, why do we devote so much time to refuting them? You know, if they're defined as things that don't exist, then we should know that they don't exist. Then we shouldn't have to refute them. So why do we spend so much time refuting things that don't exist?
We don't know, cloaked in ignorance.
Yeah, because we have mental states that exist that grasp at these things as existing. Okay, so when we refute inherent existence, we're not trying to eliminate inherent existence and make it go away because it never existed. Yeah, what we're trying to overcome is the wrong consciousness that grasps at inherent existence. You know, because that's the troublemaker, is that consciousness. Yeah, the inherent existence is, you know, as like, you know, a horn on a rabbit's head doesn't cause you any problems. Yeah, and weapons of mass destruction in Iraq don't cause you any problems. What causes us problems are the thoughts that believe those things exist. Okay. So when we talk about the negated object in the meditation on emptiness, the negated object, what we're negating is inherent existence. It's never existed, okay? But then there's the negated object of the path, and that would be the ignorance grasping at inherent existence. And that's a path is a, you know, a consciousness that's understanding, you know, reality in this case. And so, you know, if you have a path consciousness, then it's an object eliminated by the path, okay? Meaning that it's a consciousness. It's eliminated by a correct consciousness. Yeah? You have the object negated by reasoning and the object negated by the path. The object negated by reasoning is inherent existent. The object negated by the path is the ignorance grasping inherent existence.
Term grasping just stood out to me, you know.
Yeah.
Because the Buddha identified craving as the cause of cyclic existence. So there's this active process going on. It's not just perceiving inherent existence. It's grasping at.
Yeah.
So what is involved with that grasping?
Okay. Well, first the object appears to the mind as inherently existent. There's that appearance, and then the mind assents to that appearance. The mind says, yes, indeed, that is how things are right, and it holds that. Yeah? And so it apprehends that mind, or it apprehends that object as inherently existent, even though it isn't. Yeah, so it grasps it.
But it's a different term in Tibetan, grasping inherent existence and grasping it.
zin.
Yeah, it's zin.
It's not the same word as in the 12 links.
Yeah, that's why in the 12 links I translate it as craving and clinging. I don't say craving and grasping because it is a totally different term in the 12 links. Yeah, it's what is it? Upadana? Yeah, upadana in the 12 links. Yeah. Okay. Where are we? Okay. The horn of a rabbit is grammatically singular, but it is not a phenomena that is not diverse because of not being a phenomena. But you can imagine a horn on a rabbit. Also, the horn of a rabbit is not different from, for instance, a pot. A horn of a rabbit is not different from a pot? Come on. Okay. Because of not being a phenomena that is diverse from a pot. But it is different from a pot. You can sell a pot and you can't sell a horn of a rabbit.
But you can't say that a horn of a rabbit is. It doesn't exist.
Yeah. But
you can't say it is anything.
But here it just says the horn of the rabbit is not different. So it is saying something is. It's not different. You're talking about it.
Yeah.
It's a subject of a sentence. Okay. Anyway, think about it. Okay. Normally, we would say something like the horn of a rabbit is different from a handsaw. And that is true enough, but the horn of a rabbit does not have the quality of being different from a handsaw. But he just admitted you could say the horn of a rabbit is different from a handsaw. It does have a quality. In normal language, in debate language, it doesn't. Okay, that's what I'm getting at. So it doesn't, but the horn of a rabbit does not have the quality of being different from a handsaw, and it is not a phenomenon that is diverse from a handsaw. What does not exist is neither one nor different. But they say that a horn of a rabbit is empty of inherent existence. Because if somebody says, is a horn of a rabbit inherently existent? The answer is no. So it's not inherently existent. And it's in the category of the selfless. The selfless include non-existence because all those non-existent things are not inherently existent. So doesn't it seem like they have a quality of not being inherently existent? If it doesn't have any qualities, then how can you say it's empty of inherent existence? It has that quality of being empty.
It doesn't.
Is absence a quality?
Why not? We you know, it better be a quality. If we say the I is empty of inherent existence, that's important.
Negations have more to do with how we know things than the objects, how the objects exist.
Yeah, then?
So when you have a negation of something, it has, I like to say it's more on the subject side than the object side. Because so then you're taking it away from the object. It's actually what the mind is doing with it.
Mm-hmm.
That's you can't have negation without having conception.
Mm-hmm.
So it's how you're conceiving it, how you're knowing.
Yeah.
It. So it's on the side of how we know things. It's not on the side of the object.
Of the quality of the object.
Right. That's what I think.
Yeah. So you don't think that when we say, you know, the self is empty, That you don't think that emptiness is a quality of the self? You know? Empty. They say the two truths are one nature. Yeah, they depend on each other. But the difference is emptiness exists here.
We already showed last week that you could have the same nature and be mutually exclusive.
Yeah.
So that means that whatever falls in one category doesn't have to net. Is it? Yeah. Two categories are not even touching.
Yeah. But it's just it's something to think about. You know, why can't we say a non-existent? Yeah. Saying a non-existent exists sounds weird. But when you consider how much attention we pay to them. Anyway, think about it. Yeah, it came up earlier. He talked about it in one of the very early chapters. Yeah. Okay, so what does not exist is neither one nor different. The definitions for one and different in general may be applied to any particular phenomenon to generate definitions of what is one with that phenomena and what is different from that phenomena. So these can be extended endlessly. For instance, the definition of something which is one with sound is a phenomena that is not diverse from sound. Okay. An illustration is the sound of a drum, a pot, or a consciousness. Each of these is a phenomena that is... the only illustration... Okay, sorry. For instance, the definition of something which is one with sound is a phenomena that is not diverse from sound. The only illustration is sound itself, for sound alone is a phenomena that is not diverse from sound. It's one with sound. In the same way, the definition of something that is different from sound is a phenomena that is diverse from sound. An illustration is the sound of a drum. Okay, why is the sound of a drum diverse from sound? Isn't it a sound? Yeah, they're different in name, so they're not one. Yeah.
Different in meaning, too. It means only a certain sound, means...
a lot of things, yeah. But it sounds funny, isn't it? You know, a phenomena that is diverse from sound. An illustration is the sound of a drum. Sound of a drum is diverse from sound. You know, again, in regular English, we would say the sound of a drum is sound. Okay, but in debate language, you can't say that. Okay, so an illustration is the sound of a drum, a pot, or a consciousness. Each of these is a phenomena that is diverse from sound. Both one and different are permanent phenomena. What? How come they're permanent? Of course, this does not mean, this is an important point, this does not mean that whatever is one is permanent, or that whatever phenomena are different are permanent. Okay, but that in and of themselves, one is permanent and different is permanent. Okay, so in the same way, the definition is permanent and definiendum is permanent. But whatever is a definition is not necessarily permanent, and whatever is a definiendum is not necessarily permanent. And I was thinking about it. And do you remember some time ago in our class with Jeffrey, we were going over instance and generality and wondering whether generality was permanent or impermanent, because we were finding different ways in which it was spoken of. So in thinking about it, my idea is that instance and generality, just like one and different, and definiendum and definition, when talked about as a single item, they are permanent. But whatever is an instance or whatever is a generality is not necessarily permanent. There's many impermanent things. Yeah, so I think that would solve the problem that we had. Do you remember that all that many months ago?
Sometimes abstract singulars.
Yeah.
That
turns
into hope, too.
Right.
Sometimes because of abstract singulars.
Right.
Doesn't use the word category.
Yeah, so it's like, when you say definition or definiendum, yeah, if you're referring to them, yeah, as an abstract singular phenomena, then definition is not a definition. Definition is a definiendum, right? But whatever is a definition is not necessarily, no, is not necessarily, impermanent. Yeah, because there's many things that are definitions that are impermanent. So you could look at the word definition as just an abstract singular. Yeah, or you can look at the word definition as like a generality of which there's many things that are instances of it. Yeah.
Why is the abstract singular permanent?
Because it's something created by thought only.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. And because all the things that are abstract singulars, so, you know, the whole category is permanent because you have permanent and impermanent members, but the permanent dominate. Yeah.
Well, so the abstract singular though is different from the category, but both are permanent. The abstract singular is permanent because it's a conception. We get at it through meaning, conceptual appearance, and the category is permanent because of that rule.
The category. Okay, if we have the word pot, okay, if we're looking at pot as a definiendum. Mm-hmm. Okay, then it's a triply qualified and imputed existence. But everything that is a pot is not a triply qualified and imputed existent. Everything that is a pot is a triply qualified substantial existent.
Yes.
Okay. So how you're looking at pot as just as a abstract singular, or pot as a type of phenomena makes it, it's different ways of using that word, and it has different meaning. Okay? Yeah. So in the same way, the generality pot, yeah, the everything that fits into the generality of pot is impermanent, and I think that generality too must be impermanent. Yeah. But generality itself is permanent. Yeah. So something like that. Okay. Oops. Should we stop here? I'm feeling like people's energy is deflated.
Yes.
Well, since I'm not getting any answer, I guess your energy really is deflated. Okay. Yeah.
Can I ask a question?
Sure. Uh-huh.
So the horns of a rabbit, you can have a mental appearance of it, a conceptual appearance of it. And that conceptual appearance does exist.
Right.
But the phenomenon that it's referring to does not.
Right.
So if you have a temple, the conceptual appearance of a temple is in your mind, but the temple is non-existent at the moment. Right? So it's a non-existent, our temple is a non-existent phenomenon.
At the moment, but our temple is a future phenomena.
Uh-huh.
And a future phenomena is an affirmative negation. So, and affirmative negations are impermanent.
Affirming negations are impermanent.
Remember when we talked about the three times? Okay. So what's getting affirmed is there's going to be a temple. What's getting negated is not all the causes for the temple have come together. But you can't say the temple is totally non-existent, because if it were, we could never build it.
Right.
Okay. So it does not have its own entity now, but that doesn't mean it's totally non-existent.
It exists. It just doesn't exist yet.
Yeah. It's a future phenomena.
So that would be true of any creative. So you have a tune in your head. It's not a song yet, but this too is nothing. It's not. It's totally non-existent, but mm-hmm. it is a conceptual appearance in
mm-hmm.
your mind.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All the observed objects of conceptual appearances are not non-existent.
Right.
Yeah.
They do exist.
Yeah.
But the object doesn't exist. It's a future object.
Now, the future object doesn't exist now, but the future object exists. If it doesn't, if it was totally non-existent, you could never produce it. It could never arise. Okay?
And if you never, say you had the ingredients for a cake, it's a future cake.
Mm-hmm.
And then something happens with those ingredients, so you never do make the cake.
Mm-hmm.
So then it never did exist as a future cake?
No, it existed as a future cake for a while, and then it stopped existing.
Before it ever became
actual existence. The future cake stopped existing.
So it's just a conception and a hope and some
It's a non-affirming negation. Yeah. And a non-affirming negation is an impermanent phenomena, according to Prasangika. According to the other schools, they say it's permanent. But if a future object is permanent, then how can it ever come into being? Okay. So as long as the causes and conditions are there, you have the future cake. When the causes and conditions cease, then you no longer have the future cake. And the future cake is not some fully made cake that's sitting out there in space that's suddenly going to pop into appearance. Okay? And the future cake is not just your imagination. It's an impermanent phenomena. It's an impermanent phenomena. Okay? Yeah?
So this future phenomena that we're thinking about
mm-hmm.
is not just a conceptual appearance, because that's a permanent phenomenon.
So, the conceptual appearance is the permanent phenomena. The observed object of the conceptual appearance can be an impermanent phenomena.
Okay.
If you're thinking about M, is she permanent or impermanent?
She's impermanent.
Is your conceptual appearance of her permanent or impermanent?
Permanent. But in the context of a future object.
Mm-hmm.
There's not, like as you said, there's not M is sitting here next to me, a momentarily disintegrated.
Oh, I see. She's truly existent and apprehendable by your senses. And anything that does, you can't apprehend by your senses, and that isn't truly existent is non-existent.
So, yes. Okay.
Okay. So, The things that eagles see don't exist because you don't see them. And the sounds that the cats hear don't exist and that dogs hear don't exist because you don't
hear them. So there's a being that sees a future cake.
You're thinking of the future cake as you want to see something already made with frosting on it or whatever.
I'm just thinking about the question came up of like, okay, so it's an impermanent phenomenon. So it's momentarily disintegrating. What is momentarily disintegrating?
The future cake. It is momentarily disintegrating because it is approaching production. If it were permanent, it could never approach production. It could never be produced.
I can see I'm grasping at something. It's like, but what is approaching production?
The future cake.
This is Julia. We had the cake out there. So wait, I'm going to show you it already.
Yeah, I mean, that's the way our mind is thinking.
Sure.
Yeah, and then it's just going to like pop, yeah, and come in the present, and there's a time machine, and we can go back, and there they are, exactly, you know, in the past, you know, exactly as we imagine them. They still exist frozen in the past, or they're already there in the future, you know. We're just waiting for, you know, pop, and then there they go, just like in the movies. You know? That's what we think. That is non-existent.
Do you think that's our distortion of permanence?
Yeah, no, it's just our difficulty in creative thinking, I think. So does your Buddhahood exist?
Yes.
Does it exist now? Is it in the process of coming into being?
Yes. Do I really understand why my Buddhahood exists? I mean, I can say yes, but I don't really get it.
Yeah, yeah. You have to understand how attaining awakening is possible. And that depends on real understanding emptiness.